You're listening to Circle of Hope Sunday Meeting Podcast. This talk was given at 3800 Marlton Pike. For more information, check out circleofhope.net or join us in person on Sunday mornings at 10:30 a.m. or 7 o'clock p.m.
So my topic for today is selfishness, self-loathing, and the Imago Dei. And Rod used to always get very upset with me. I think he's more used to it after all these years of marriage. But whenever we would argue, I would bring examples from everywhere and connect them and demonstrate how he should fall at my feet and ask forgiveness. My mind works like that. And so what I hope to do today is connect selfishness, self-loathing, and the Imago Dei in your mind. This idea that we are in the image of God. I think we live in a time where we're really pretty confused. There's a lot of interest in teaching us how to love ourselves, right? You hear it everywhere. But then there's also this loud cry, I think particularly since November, and I won't go into the details of that, but about not being selfish, right? And those seem to be colliding all around us. I think we're caught in the middle of sort of a whirling storm of ideas and of advertising. And it all pulls us one way, and then it pulls us in the exact opposite way. And so, as in many things, I think what's underneath both of these warring camps vying for our attention, maybe our money, maybe our hearts, there's actually something good under both sides of this. I think we need to understand our selfishness, really understand it, the ways we take and use, the ways we desperately grab or hoard. We need to understand that, and we also need to understand the ways that this dramatically hurts us. We need to understand these desperate parts of ourselves and find a way to freedom. And we need to understand the depths of God's love and the boundless grace Christ has won for us, the joy and the goodness that we were created to live in, even in times like these. We truly are saints, right? We are the beloved of God, made strong in his very image, in her very image. And we are sinners, a broken reflection of what we were created to be, actually separated from the source of our life, separated from God, and even from our true selves. And so, there we are at this conflicted interchange. As I was a young Christian trying to understand myself and the ways of God in the world, these verses sent me on a long and a wild detour in my life, particularly concerning our topic. Don't be selfish. Don't live to make a good impression on others. Be humble, thinking of others as better than yourself. Don't just think about your own affairs, but be interested in others too and in what they are doing. So for me, what that translated to was something like this, right? The wishes of everybody but me get priority, right? Gwen, you are worthless except for what you can do for others. I don't think I really knew I thought that, but I really thought that, and I lived that. And what happened next was this. And so following Christ somehow led me away from freedom and into a kind of poverty that I think God had no interest in me being in. See, as I learned, and we all learn actually in childhood, ways to get what we need, what we actually need, and certainly that ties into what we want. I wasn't always successful. None of us are always successful in this. The reality is that others aren't always up to the task of taking care of us. That's just reality. We humans learn by interpreting the events around us. We look around and we figure out how to speak, how to ask. We interpret how to act by what we experience, by what we see around us, by what repeats. And there are holes in this system There are holes everywhere. I wasn't just like someone. You fill in the blank. I think you could play this game with me. I wasn't. In my case, I had an older sibling, and I wasn't just like him. And he seemed to get a lot of attention in my family system. And so I craved getting some more attention, and so I thought I needed to be like him. I was way too this, or I believed that I needed to be different in some other way to find love. I'm hoping you're relating to this kind of thought process. I developed strategies to try to save myself from the loneliness, the criticism, the neglect. In my case, I think what I developed was a radical fear of selfishness. And so I interpreted a lot of behavior and a lot of thoughts as potentially selfish. When I then became a Christian, coming out of that family and those kinds of thinking, I just applied all those old lessons to what I read in the Bible. So when I read Paul talking to his friends in Philippi, I thought he was saying the same thing I'd always thought, that I needed to put others before myself in a way that was actually degrading to my person. One of my particular challenges, of course, was, well, maybe not of course, but for my family, it was I learned via this older brother that men were more important than women, that they were preferred, that they got what they needed and could aspire to do things I found myself attracted to do, only I was locked out. Now, if you aren't aware, I'm older than everybody in the room. And so in my day, what that meant was that I could never do what I'm doing in this very moment. I couldn't ask God to use the words of my mouth in order to bring himself honor because women did not speak in church. And yet I found myself drawn to those very kinds of gifts. So that was more despair. I had learned how to hear what God called. No. I had to learn how to hear what God called me to do in the midst of whatever was going on around me. And first in that was the call that God wanted me to give myself as I am, even as a woman, to him fully. I wanted to give my best self. And this is sort of the way we go about living, we humans. We begin to translate what's happening around us so that this best self that we want to give, I think many of you would tell me about the ways that you want to do your best for God even. But what it unfortunately translates into in our behavior and in our thought is a kind of false self. And the person I learned to be in the rough and tumble of my family life and in my school, etc., is not actually the person that Jesus delights in. When I met Jesus, I was so glad to give myself to him. I was overjoyed that God wanted me. Because coming from this place that I've described, I really very easily believed no one wanted me. And now I had this news that someone not only wanted me, but loved me. It was revolutionary, and soon I took all of that good, all of that revolution, right back to my old patterns of prioritizing others' wishes and getting battered around by trying to please others, hide my true gifts because they were masculine, whatever that was. But beneath all of that, continuing to believe that I was unworthy of care. Do you get this collision? Here was God revealing to me that I was the loved person. I got it. And soon I was back translating all of that somehow into loss, somehow into my unworthiness. I was performing the same old dance I learned, even though my faith affirmed something far different. I think that's the way it happens for so many of us. In my counseling offices, I hear it many, many days, how we lay a kind of Christian veneer over the top of these same old ways of being. This requires that you and I repress a lot of our true feelings to pull it off, and it begins to build up this complete ocean of despair within us. And I had begun a genuine relationship with Jesus, but I was still living, thinking, and behaving as if I were stuck in this old place. These unconscious motives, the things I'd learned, held me there. I was still trying to earn love, although I was unaware of how I longed for something new. God wanted me to consent to a radical transformation, and it would require that I give up all these unconscious ways I had amassed to save myself. I don't know if I would have known to call it that then, but that's exactly what it was. I'm getting a little ahead of myself. Let's go back to some scripture. So, no, let's not. Let's talk about this tension. Because I think we really live in this paradox. It's part of the mystery of, oh, wait. There it is. You read that while I keep talking. Sorry, I'm a little befuddled with this. I reprinted this morning, and I think I clicked through too many. This, I think, affirms what I'm talking about, the both and of the reality of who we are and how we live. We are in this time when something new has been given to us in Christ, and yet we are sinners, given a gift and yet caught in the mess, restored and yet with all the potential to stay right in the middle of that very tension. God speaks and says, let us make human beings in our image, make them reflecting our nature. That's when life feels like life, when we again find our way to this salvation given us in Christ Jesus. And it comes by way of working with all these tensions, all that we live in the paradox of our lives. There are simply lots of unknowns in Christianity. There's lots of requirement for trust. We don't get a rule, we get a person, we get a relationship. Jesus certainly met me way back in the day, but it took him several decades to get me to understand these ways I was trying to save myself. Jesus keeps challenging all of my performance goals. It's terrifying. Only I've been told not to fear. So then I try to repress all the things I've learned about myself so that I can somehow be a good Christian. And then as I repress them, I think that's one really boiling pot of trouble that I make for myself. And actually, I think one of the reasons that we're in this whirlwind in our world about selfishness promotion is that for a couple of centuries, the Christian church has really emphasized that we as human beings are a wreck, that we are bad. And so we've got this sort of counterpoint coming from our amoral, a-religious culture now, saying, no, we're, you know, selfishness is fine. We need to promote ourselves. And I think what I'm saying is that I don't think the world is right. I don't think that that's got the right ticket. But I am saying that as a result of our sin, as a result of this brokenness in us, we do get caught in these cycles of unconsciously trying to be good enough or smart enough or loving enough or something. We try to overcome sin in ourselves. We tell ourselves that we are good enough, that we'll be okay, and then we fall off because obviously we get messy and we don't live up to any of those standards that we make. This isn't the message of Jesus, by the way. His is the message that we need to pay attention to. This message of sort of being okay and of resting in what you've got, all that stuff, is more like the moralistic therapeutic deism that's running around, that Christian Smith did some research on and is actually making lots of money now talking about. Big survey for those of you who are in your 20s, early 30s. He asked a whole bunch of people, and it's been, what, 8 years ago now, I think, that he did this massive survey, and he came up with this title for the way we've been taught to believe that we're really okay, and you just have to kind of be nice to others. I think it's sort of a script for how we have to contort ourselves to try to please others. But it's surprising how many people who come to places just like this on Sundays across the United States believe that really it's just about trying to be nice. And I think that leads us down a very, very bad path. In my case lately, I've been reflecting on how I tried so hard to be loving after I became a Christian. And really, is that a bad goal? Well, in my life, yes, it absolutely was. Whatever I tried to do that wasn't loving then, if I've got my intention on I'm going to be loving, then I'm not going to pay attention to the ways that I'm not loving. In fact, I'm even going to repress those because those damage my ability to feel okay about myself, to think I'm nice. And so you see how the cycle goes. In fact, I would suggest to you, if you pay attention to your own if-then statements that are running in the back of your mind all the time, if I do this, then this will happen, you'll begin to get a glimpse a bit deeper into your own sort of coping strategies, what you do to try to save yourself. For me, one of the statements that ran long and hard was, if I please others, then they'll love me. If I put them ahead of me and don't ever demand anything, then they will attend to me. And of course, in repressing all of my desires and pushing all of my preferences out of my own awareness because I feared being rejected, that only left me alone, right? It had to leave me alone because I was never really in the room in any genuine encounter with any other human being, right? It only made all of those desires bigger, by the way. It only made them fiercer. They didn't magically go away, and those I was trying to love with my strategy of putting them ahead of me and being non-demanding, I'm sure felt all the more demanded of from me. I was pretty intense, I still am, but hopefully a bit more conscious about all of that. So I don't like this title, but it's what I settled on anyway, that I needed to figure out something about good selfishness. Now, this is not about disregarding others. It is not about getting everything we could ever want with no consideration of others. That would ruin us. We are designed by the holy communal God. We're supposed to be in relationship. And if we go about it with a complete self-focus, we lose. Good selfishness is the courage to prioritize ourselves in order to restore our resources. I really needed to work with that a good bit so that I didn't end up so completely spent that all my unconscious stuff jumped into the mix. Good selfishness is an ability to state our needs forthrightly with self-awareness. It's the opposite of feeling a desire and tapping it down or ignoring it because I expect it to be ignored. Although I'm presupposed still to this day to think I will be ignored. God's image in me should not be ignored. God's image in you should not be ignored. But I repeatedly ignored that. That was a product of sin at work in the world. But unfortunately, what I did with that was that I contributed to my own variation of sin and the way I perpetuated it, so I joined in by ignoring myself. Then when I got into relationships where someone did want to attend to me and love me, I brought an unconscious boatload of repressed anger, of expectation of being ignored, so I read that into everything. I would not be demanding, so I would not tell what I truly wanted, but boy, would you know it if you didn't give it to me. Or I would try not to want, try to nip it way back at the bottom of the bud until I couldn't stand it anymore, and then I'd lash out, I'd condemn others for not caring about me, you know the drill. There's a hidden hope in this kind of thinking, being, that if I don't attend to my needs, then you'll have to. And that's a very hard thing to give up. It's a kind of a reverse coercion aimed at still getting what I want. Stating my needs, owning them consciously, is really all I can do. You will not escape what's in you. You will not escape your unconscious. But you can begin to work with those things. You must, actually. I believe the call of Christ is the call to a more conscious life. So I don't end up endlessly, unconsciously coercing others while I pretend or I try to think I'm providing for them. I usually would end up in a lot of despair in this cycle. I would contend then that good selfishness is really an effort to know myself and to actually serve others more deeply, more authentically, more sustainably. We certainly can grow bitter and lose sight of the love of God in the midst of all of this. So here's how I think the unconscious works. We repress that which is uncomfortable or unacceptable. We take those feelings that we can't process and they just get packed down inside of us. We are like a dry riverbed. We're hard and we don't even know it. The truth is that these unprocessed feelings tend to sneak up on us and in unexpected ways. We build up generalized kind of an intense anxiety that's just free-floating and vague because we've got stuff stuck in that riverbed. We might feel unexplainably or unrelentingly sad. In fact, sometimes we can feel sad about everything because we haven't allowed ourselves to be sad about the one thing that we need to be sad about. We slide into despair and often into self-loathing in this desperate cycle. We end up, many, many people that I talk to daily end up in this cycle of self-loathing. And it seems to be affirmed by their Christian faith. That's the tragedy of all of this. I want to go back to Romans. Listen to it again. But in our time, something new has been added. What Moses and the prophets witnessed to all those years ago has happened. The God setting things right that we read about has become Jesus setting things right for us. And not only for us, but for everyone who believes in him. For there is no difference between us and them in this. Since we've compiled this long and sorry record as sinners, both us and them, and proved that we are utterly incapable of living the glorious lives God wills for us, God did it for us. Out of sheer generosity, God put us in right standing, a pure gift. God got us out of the mess we were in and restored us to where God always wanted us to be. And God did it by means of Jesus Christ. Indeed. But the problem remains that we might get into this we might get this kind of truth into about the top 3 inches of our foreheads. We get it to our frontal lobes, the front part of our brain. It doesn't make it into our full understanding. It doesn't get to our feelings. It doesn't get to our hearts. The problem is that we are still these rock-hard riverbeds. And so much of our Christianity is delivered to us just like I'm trying to deliver it to you now. It's going right here. What are we to do? I think this is the hope of our faith. Bits of water reviving the riverbed slowly and tenderly. This is... Yeah, there it is. This is what God is about. What God has always wanted for you and I is very simple. He wants us to give ourselves completely, unabashedly, totally to God, to belong to God, to make our home in God. After about 15 years of running through this cycle as a young Christian, I was really spent and very despairing. And then I found contemplative prayer. I began to just practice. I began to journey into the silence. And what silence, stillness, and prayer has done for me over the 30 years I've practiced is something I cannot explain to you in these words. But I know that what it has done is to bring the reality of my salvation fully into my experience, to challenge all of that early life experience. I have had more experiences with Christ than I had in my original family, but I still have this tension. And so I pray. I pray so that I will know I've been saved. Sounds a little too elementary, but I'm pretty basic. I pray so that I know I'm made in the image of God, and I need it constantly. I need to know I'm strong and gifted and loving, that I'm longing for connection because that's what's right to long for. I know I'm a sinner too, that the transformation is partial but ongoing, and this is the tension of life. Both of those things, neither cancel the other out. Dan talked about that prayer that his friend taught him earlier. It's the Jesus prayer. Christians have been praying that prayer for centuries and centuries. Jesus Christ, Son of the living God, have mercy on me, a sinner. I like admitting I'm a sinner because I really like affirming, knowing again that I have a Savior who is as close to me as my very breath. I learned to be a doer. I think most of us in our culture have. So this prayer of contemplative practice is hard for us because it requires us to sit still. And I'm recommending to you this morning, again, nothing new. Go home and sit in your chair. Do this. Give yourself to God and wait. You'll see the difference. It might not be what you expect, though. And from my experience, it will every time take longer than you think it should. Recently, I sat with my spiritual director, and we were exploring my confusion coming off a very long and difficult summer. Nothing that I expected had happened this summer. I had retired from my 22 years in academia. I was excited to sort of have a wide open space. I was still going to do work with circle counseling, but I really just wanted to listen to God. And on the first day, practically, that was a possibility in my life, my son came to me and told me that his wife was leaving him. And so it's been this horrible summer of walking with my dear son, who feels destroyed. And I've asked God over and over about this as I've bounced around with Luke's pain all summer. And my contemplative practice was as messy as my heart. I couldn't deal with my anger. I couldn't deal with my hurt. I couldn't deal with the kinds of things he was saying about himself. And in the midst of all my sitting in my chair, those thoughts were way more prominent, even as I tried repeating, "Jesus Christ, Son of the Living God, have mercy on me, a sinner." And after months of doing that, trying to follow that dutifully, I sat with my spiritual director and we were talking about this. And in the midst of that, I suddenly became aware of what was going on. That as much as my pain was for Luke, it was also a lot about the echoing of the past. That because of what had happened to Luke, I somehow believed again that God would ignore us. I learned that over 60 years ago, and in spite of all the contradictory experiences I've had with God, it's still there, and I still need God to bring water to my dry, rock-hard soul. And he still does. We're all these dry riverbeds covered in stones that we've carried for too many years. Our sin makes us hard, but God's story about us is vastly different. God's story of us is of water running and soaking into the cracks and crevices and softening our hearts and changing our understanding of ourselves and even our understanding of our own errors, of our own sin. Even when the world hurts, God meets us. I'll close with this story that I just heard in my time with MCC. MCC is a very wide tent, so we got people who plain dress, and we've got people who come from a Native American tradition in their moccasins, and we've got African Americans in their dreads, and next day a blonde wig or something. And so it's a wide tent, but this story comes out of the Old Order Brethren about a bishop who drove to a meeting one evening in his horse and buggy, his cart, his horse, went into the meeting, and there were some young men who decided that they would enjoy themselves by pranking the bishop, and so they piled his horse cart full of stones, stone upon stone. And when the bishop came out, it was dark and he didn't notice the stone, so he got into his seat and began to try to coax his horse to take him home, and the horse just couldn't move, strained and pulled, and the cart was too heavy. So then the bishop discovered what had happened, that his cart was full of rock, and so he took several hours unloading all of those stones. And then he went home. A couple of decades later, one of the young men, now grown man, who had done that, was talking to one of his friends and said, "You know, I have to admit, I've always felt terrible about what we did to the bishop." And they were talking more, and they decided they needed to go find this old bishop at this point and confess what they'd done and ask his forgiveness, to apologize. So they found him. And they apologized to him. And he smiled at them and apologized right back. And he said, "I'd spent a few hours carrying those stones. You've had to carry them for years." I think that's the way of Christ. And there is a way to freedom here. Bless you.
Thanks for listening to Circle of Hope's Sunday Meeting Podcast. If you want to talk about it or get connected to a cell, you can find one under our Connect dropdown at circleofhope.net.